Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Heck yes!
As we all know, all great teams are just two people, Batman and Robin.
Specifically, all great teams are two people that used to be three people, but then one of them has like a big important gig and can't be there. That's what makes for a great team.
Yeah, you're saying that like somebody moved on and it's more important. Somebody thinks that there's a more important show to do than this show. Gotcha.
Yeah. Name one national convention happening right now.
Yeah. I don't know. What I do know is that we've got some email from people, and just to let you know, on After Things, what we do is we try to lend our
experience.
Yeah, and our point of view on things.
There you
which,
go.
Be honest with you, is you know, as I sit here in the squalor of my Burbank apartment, you know, take everything with just a grain of salt. You know, like we'll tell you our thoughts on things, but not like we're captain. You know, Brian's done pretty well for himself. So,
you know. if you want to know,
Brian's got multiple enterprises.
I'm pretty much
going
the best.
I'm a lazy man
at making beautiful little girls. So if you need to know how to make little girls and how to handle taking them to the emergency room when they split their lips and foreheads, I've got that down.
Got it done. I mean, I write books and I make TV and stuff like that, but I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. I still consider myself a failure. So here is somebody who's not a failure, Brian.
Oh, good.
This is from Joe.
Right on.
Joe Diamond. Joe Diamond writes in. He says, "Hello, gentlemen. I'm a Chicagoland mentalist. I usually hear Chicagoland with the words like slayings.
Yes, murders. Yes. Or gangs.
But the Chicagoland mentalist, like, oh, dude, like, he will know that you sold out solely and he will have you killed. Like, don't even cross paths with the Chicagoland mentalist."
Sure.
So Joe, the Chicagoland mentalist, is doing shows in a reportedly haunted mansion. He puts "reportedly" in quotes. Since it's become a great little summer project as I go through my summer slump and before things pick up again in the fall or Halloween and corporate work in December, shows have been selling out. And I'm working hard on getting the last few shows off the month to sell out as well. I'm looking for new ways to promote. I've done all the usual stuff and it has been working. Email list, newspaper, web listings, Facebook ads. I'm looking for new ways to bring in audiences. So far, it's been mostly seniors and even families. I've got a few people in their early 20s coming this week. I'd like to get more college students before summer is over. I feel like I'm doing the right things, but I'm missing out on the new right things. Let me know if you've got any other ideas. Love the show. Thanks so much, Joe Diamond.
Oh, man, I wish I had a little more clarity on what's being done. So we're probably going to give a bunch of ideas that we're just going to imagine that half the things we say, you're nodding, saying, yep, I've been doing that. Well, I guess one of the things we don't have is a sense of how full is sold out, because a strategy to bring in 20 people is a different strategy than to bring in 200 people. But all that, okay. There's a couple of different things you could do. The hardest thing for most people is to come up for a reason for why you are reaching out to someone. People, it feels weird. Like you could basically announce, "Hey, everyone, I got my show. It's here." And then what? Do you just keep shouting that same thing? No, that's weird and makes you not want to do it. So if you can build into it, one thing that we have been doing that's worked out very, very well on our weekly giveaway videos when we announce new stuff on the Scam School channel is we keep putting new puzzles, new twists on there. You know, the format of each episode is exactly the same, except for now that we have hidden codes and puzzles, there's always something new that attracts people to come back, even if they look at the title and they say, "Well, I don't need a fire blasting screwdriver, but I do like solving that puzzle, so I'll go there." Likewise, if your show is the same and stays the same, you can figure out some way to add a always evolving element to it that makes it newsworthy or noteworthy, worth reaching out. You know, hopefully you have an email address because you're doing giveaways and you're building up your groups. Hopefully you're figuring out maybe a one-time event where it's refer someone to come in, and they get a free pass for themselves or someone, like bring a friend, you come free or whatever. You know, don't forget that you could do unlimited one-off special events. And if you do it and it works really well, that doesn't mean you can't do it again. It just means you can't call it the same thing or say it's the same thing. Or maybe the story is, hey, we're doing this one-time event. Oh, the whole world loved it. Guess what? We're bringing back the one-time event again. It was so good. The other thing, complete opposite side, is your show is inherently newsworthy, even though it may not feel like it. You can figure out just about any current event that you can hang your hat on it. So instead of having a press release that goes out to everyone that always says the same thing, magic show still in town, doing a thing. You could celebrate, you know, the anniversaries. You can announce new things, or you could say, psychic predicted Trump victory with this whatever, and you can make a viral video proves psychic predicted whatever. You can get anybody working in news is looking for some kind of angle to not just say the same thing everyone else is saying. And if you can provide that and use that as a peg to hook a plug for your show or for what you do, you're going to reach a whole bunch of people. And there's great books on that. The Rise of PR, The Death of Advertising. There's another one. I can't remember. It was from a news guy out of Dallas. Wrote a really good one as well. Anyway, lots of different ways to do that.
My thoughts on this, so I clicked this link through there. And Joe, I think your website, by the way, your personal website, I think is a really well laid out website. I would say the problem is like right now, the banner at the very top, like I had to look twice to find the link in it that's above the fold even there. You can't even see it on our Skype view unless we scroll it lighter. So it seats 13 people. You've got this great, great story hook, the fact that it is in this reportedly haunted mansion. I would the two areas that I would really want to focus on when it comes to local coverage is TV and radio. For TV is get hold of the TV stations and make a pitch to them. Say, hey, we're doing this exclusive 13-person only mentalism show in this haunted mansion. Would you guys like to come down and shoot or do whatever? If it's because it might be a very interesting story for people who do cultural stuff, is like, oh, there's like a, you know, an exclusive magic show that takes place in this mansion. Okay. Use the words exclusive. Okay. And use the word mental. Yeah. Mentalism instead of mental, you know, that in a haunted mansion. Pitch to the local TV networks is what you want to get is, if you have the people who do the kind of the regular sort of, you know, fun coverage, you want to get them to come down. They pick stories that have visual elements and say, hey, and we might see a few ghosts while we're there. You know, I'll give you a tour. Can I give your host a tour? And then they could watch one of the magic shows. Pitch that to multiple stations and see if they respond, because that is, if you hit them on the right day, they'll be like, oh, that's great. Let's send somebody down there, because it's got a really good TV news hook for local television. So pitch that to local radio. Is the idea with local radio shows is put together your on-air radio mentalism stuff and say, hey, can I call in from the haunted mansion here and do a mentalism bit? It's on, for some reason it works better here. And I don't really believe in that stuff, but it works better there. That's a cool radio bit. Like, oh, he's calling us right now from the haunted mansion, the most haunted room there. And he's going to do, you know, he's going to try to read so-and-so's mind.
And keep in mind, like the value of that is not just the segment. The segment is going to be 5 minutes long in between traffic and weather together on the fives. What they get out of it is they get to amp up the perceived value of their show as they plug it, you know, for mm-hmm. hours and hours and hours leading up to that moment.
Yeah. So, yeah, man, Joe, you did a brilliant choice in choosing this venue. I've learned from you in what you've done here, and that a really interesting venue amplifies what you're doing. So I think that play that up, use that advantage of those are things I would do to get publicity, to get people in the door. Here's the thing that you can do too, is that this is some advice. Now with 13, it's limited. If I was going to go do a show, like a live magic show in LA, and I really wanted important people to go see it, I would work out a deal with the museum, the observatory, and all the places that have a membership level, that have a really expensive level of membership, and say, hey, can I do a fundraiser for you? Will you guys promote this thing or whatever? And I will do it free of cost. all the door goes to you guys or whatever, because that then promotes me out to people on that list and they hear about the show and what I'm doing. So if I were trying to reach other audiences, if I were in Chicago, are there escape rooms there? Can you use their emails? Escape rooms that have become super popular, those sort of attractions, they have an email list of people who love to go out and do adventurous things. Talk to them, say, hey, I'll pay you 30% of a ticket or whatever, 20% or 10% if you send out an email promoting my magic show. So reach out to escape room, see if they'll let you use their email list. Reach out to other places that have a higher ticket, sort of higher membership levels, and those are, you know, really good resources.
You know, you could even work out a deal with escape rooms, because what happens is you get a group of people, let's say seven people, they just finished the thing. They're like, that's really fun. What's the next thing people say? We should do something like this again. And if mm-hmm. you work out a deal with an escape room where it's like, hey, did you enjoy it? Would you like to do something like this? Only it's a bit of a supernatural thing. There's this event. It takes place, whatever. Don't hand them a coupon or a flyer or whatever. Say, if you will sell, can I make you a ticket seller? And you could just make 30% on all the tickets. It's a way for you to get an easy extra $150 out of excited groups right as they're walking out the door. You get to cash in right there on the spot.
And yeah, absolutely. There's a reason why, like in New York, like a lot of the smaller theaters band together and they put out things like Playbill, and they put out these things to sort of share an audience, because they only have enough content for that audience one or two times a year.
Right.
And the same with an escape room or whatever. But if you go to them and say, hey, I have a non-competing form of, you know, content that you guys can make money from, et cetera, you know, it's an underutilized. When I talk to magicians and I ask them, like, where are you, you know, where's your email list? Like, I'm always surprised, like, why aren't you talking to other people that are in the same, like, other, just like, no, other people, other kind of one-time attractions that are trying to fill rooms, because you could do exactly what Brian says. You know, you could say, at the end of my show, I'll pitch you guys pitch me, whatever, and then you let us share our email lists, and, you know, things would work out really well.
Yeah, and Playbill, I think, was a really good example, because it made me think, there was a brief period when I was doing colleges that, you know, everybody is doing direct mailers at the time. This was 15 years ago. Email marketing wasn't as effective or as pervasive as it is right now. So we had talked about, like, okay, all of us are going to do one nationwide mailing per year. What if eight of us got together and instead of for the same cost as each of us doing one nationwide mailer, we would put all of our stuff and make our own 8-page magazine. Maybe one page would be different and unique, and we'd all take turns being on the cover of the magazine, I'm using air quotes, and then on inside we could have an editorial page filled with advice on, you know, booking lots of people at your events, and pretty much all the rest of it is just a shuffling of our ads over and over and over again. I still think that would have been a great idea, but unfortunately, it never came to pass. Be thinking in those terms, and I think you hit the nail right on the head, Andrew, when you were saying that there's only so much content, and you feel like it's one and done. There, think of every other event that feels the same way you do, and figure out how you guys can just trade the same folks around.
Yeah, I would offer you one piece of advice, Mr. Diamond, if that you have the opportunity. The photos on your show, they're not what I expect that I'm going to go see, like a spooky magic show in a mansion. You know, that's not what I expect to see. I feel like I'm looking at like a rec center kind of thing.
And these are all they're all candid shots that
they're real like shows. But I would, if there's a way to stage it or do, I know it's late to ask, but like if you could even black and white or some way to
turn off the lights and set a candle and then get, you know, ask some friends over, like, hey, can I do my routines for you? And we'll just have this candle here and hopefully we'll get some good.
What are we going to do it there? Like, and we'll talk too about, like, I think you need to dress more theatrical for that environment.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, Brian, your thoughts?
No. I agree. I don't want to. I just want to work under the assumption that the show itself is perfect as is, and just
I guess my point of view is, like, if you want to get a TV news crew, if you want to get people in there and you want to get them to go, this is great, we want to cover this, you need to give them a product.
And you know, the moment they look at your website, they have to be able to picture what this segment will look like when they put it together.
Yeah, a guy in a, and again, I'm all for certain environments addressing like that, but a guy in a polo shirt and blue jeans who's doing a show, I mean, because the spooky minimalism show, all this sounds great, and I look at this like, oh, just a regular guy doing a card trick. It's like, I'm like, Joe, like you've got a great sight. You've got a great sense on a lot of these things. Like I would, you know, don't be afraid to amp it up. When you go to the Disney Haunted Mansion, you know, everybody from the moment you walk into the gate, they're no longer happy Disney people. They're in character. And it's very, very, and I'm not saying go bizarre, but a suit or something that just elevates this whole thing. It's just a thought.
Well, especially if what you want to do is reach for the high end, there's two ways to make more money. One is to sell out all your shows, which you're certainly working on right now, but that's an achievable goal that might happen in just a few months. All of your time might be booked. And in that case, the only place for you to go is to adjust the price. And that means you need to make it more of a high-end experience, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you look at his homepage and you look at the photo there, you know, the first photo is great.
I want to see that guy in those photos.
Yep, I want to see that guy. You know, he's wearing a suit, he's wearing a tie, he's got a key on his lapel. That's the guy I want to see, you know, doing the show there. That's just my thought on it, you know, so.
Yeah, that opening photo looks fantastic.
Yeah, and Joe, you've done a great job. This is all coming from, if I were to say what I would do, and we're not telling you what you need to do because you know better than that, so.
Does he have a podcast, Unreal Radio? Oh, that's wonderful. That's a great idea, by the way. It's a domain, a secondary domain that establishes you as a expert. Even if your clients or the people come to the show never watch this thing, just knowing that it's out there matters and helps.
Yeah. Again, Joe, I think you have a really well done website here. I think you've got it really well presented. So often, you know, we click through on stuff and it's like just no thought. It was just, everything was done as an afterthought, but it's the first impression.
Yeah.
The first impression people get is your website, is that interaction. And we treat it like it's such a secondary, ancillary sort of thing because our first impression is ourselves, but it's the opposite. It's not the tail end. It's the first, their doorway. And if you look at this doorway and it looks run down and it's looking in a crappy neighborhood and you're like, I'm not going to knock.
Yeah.
So,
you know what? I would even wonder, like that banner, the logo is really awesome, the JD of Joe Diamond, but the unfortunate placement is that I only see the top half of his head. I almost wonder if I wouldn't rather see that logo superimposed on the photo. So the first thing I see is him.
What's a video?
Well, exactly, or whatever it is. My point is, it's framed such that I see a name and half a face. Is the most I can see. I never get to see.
Oh, it's full screen on my web.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. This is a 720p display here.
So. I see the whole thing. Let's move on to another magician here. I'm picking up a theme.
By the way, Bobby, I'm okay with this theme. If after things just becomes us giving the best advice we can to every magician, a variety or entertainer out there, that'd be great.
If you say so, Brian. Robbie writes, hey guys, just thought I'd share with you what I've been going through the last couple of months. My name is Robbie Johnson. I'm a magician working in the middle of Wisconsin. I've been doing magic more as a hobby and using it as an icebreaker when at the hotel bar that I work at. But in early June, the general manager of the hotel asked me to do a couple of tricks for a work meeting. And of course I did. And after, she asked me if I had ever done walk around magic in shows. I'd done a couple of stage tricks for variety shows and of course close-up magic for friends and people at the bar, but never gotten paid for a gig. My manager goes on to tell me that she's part of the Chamber of Commerce in a nearby city and said they were looking for a magician to work the 4th of July festival. I explained that I'd never actually done it before, but I felt more comfortable performing, and eventually I got booked and was extremely excited. The Chamber and I decided that I would do walk-around magic for guests at the festival during the day and in the night with a 15 to 20-minute magic fire-eating show right before the fireworks start. The point of this email is to tell you how much help this podcast was to help me understand how to talk with the Chamber and how to prepare for what was ahead of me. And again, especially thank Brian for the help he personally gave me with how to write my fire eating routine, among other things. Since the 4th of July, Chamber asked me to work future events, and I'm also talking with a couple of campgrounds around the area that have asked me if I could perform with them on weekends. Again, thank you guys. It helped me a tremendous amount, and I know I'm not the only one, so thank you. Oh, cool. Well, that's no question. He's just wanted to.
Well, congratulations. But you know what we can talk about is how do you do that first kind of opportunity? How do you gauge how much to charge or what to expect because oftentimes, you know, you don't know, like, I don't know, how much do you want to give me or whatever?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple ways to go into that. And it depends. One is like, are you part of a magic community and you have people you can ask? Because the danger is you're better off asking other magicians what to charge, because What they don't want is somebody undercharging.
Yep.
You know, they don't want, you know, if the standard sort of thing for a half hour or for an hour of walk around is $350, if you're going out there selling it for $150, then you and you could be getting more. You're doing a disservice, one, to yourself for your price, and two, is that if somebody's calling around getting quotes and they hear this one guy says $150, you know, the $350, it doesn't mean the guy automatically gets, who's at $150 gets the job. It means they're going like, I don't know if I really want magic. I don't even, can't even figure out what you're supposed to pay.
Right. Well, and plus that, it's like, let's say in that example, the first thing someone's going to think is like, well, what's wrong with his act that he's charging less than half of everyone else? But mm-hmm. then, so not only does it hurt your chance of getting the gig, but word gets around because there's only two magicians in any city, and they're going to be like, man, you hear this other guy's trying to undercut us, charging only $150 or whatever. Yeah.
And there are exceptions to that, too, in that there are, if you're performing for different socioeconomic classes, too, and that's a thing that, I, you know, in Miami is that if you are doing, you know, depends, the show price depends upon the zip code. You know, if you're doing something in Palm Beach, in the beach part of Palm, you know, the nice, super nice area of that, and the, you know, Jupiter Island or Miami and like the really nice areas there versus if you're doing something more in the suburbs, pricing's going to be different. And that, a lot of magicians weren't conscious of that too. And they, you know, and it's that, and it's not just because, oh, you're going to charge the wealthy people more. No, it's because they're going to expect, you know, I got to show up to that gig. I got to wear my, you know, my $2,000 suit, you know, well,
And that's the thing, man, is the show is the same for a high-end corporate event with 2,000 people in the audience as for an informal birthday, you know, party with 200 people in the room. Let's say it's the exact same 40 minutes that I'm going to do. There is a fundamentally different expectation about having being there, showing up early, going through sound checks, having everything. You have to show up a full day early for the corporate version of this thing, even though it's the same show. You have to go through and show your entire act to make sure everyone in tech understands it because they cannot afford to have anything fail and so on. So it's not, it's don't confuse, your product is not just what you do. Your product is also how you make people feel, and what hoops you jump through, and that'll be different for every event.
Yeah. And there's, if you know, if you're going to a catered party and you're performing there, it's like, yeah, they don't want, I mean, they may invite you to hang out and linger around, but you're better to get out of there. But if you're, you know, more of a company picnic kind of family picnic kind of thing, you get hired to go do it. And it's a more informal kind of thing. And hey, he's going to hang out afterwards and eat with the buffet with us. What I mean, you know, there's different levels and things like that. But it's sidetracked here. Point is that find out pricing's important. The open way is just to call up some magicians, say, hey, I'm a local guy, I'm doing shows. I don't want to screw this thing up. And everybody's going to perceive you as competition. That's for sure. But if you're, and so the open way, if you don't know enough magicians, find a way, go to meetings, go to magic club meetings. But a lot of times there, those guys aren't actually doing shows. Find out where to start with pricing. The subtle way is to have a friend call and find out, get quotes on stuff. You know, I mean, that's maybe shady, but if you know that you're not going to get an honest answer, then use a subterfuge to find out what pricing is going for.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, it doesn't hurt to call them directly and say, hey, I'm another magician here. Mm-hmm. I am, just be honest. Like, I don't know.
Approach? But I'm saying is that you get there. I've heard stories of for the other hand, like, yeah, some guy called me, some local guy wanted, I lied to him, you know, I'm like, told him this or whatever. And it's like, it can be weird. It depends. It's such a weird, it's hard to know. And I always say, defer to the honest approach, but I've been aware of many situations where magicians are so territorial and threatened by somebody else asking them, they have given them intentionally bad advice and done things to them.
Man, I really wish you weren't so right. I definitely know that can be the case.
But that's why if you can go to magic clubs and meet people in person, it's harder for them to lie to you and be dishonest to you. If you're just a guy on the phone, then they will do that. But and that's the unfortunate part is that it's not this great brotherhood where we're looking out for everybody. And now those markets, those small markets, those people are super, they know that, you know, they want the person's going to pull up the Google search or the phone book or whatever. They know there are three other people that are going to get the call, and they're competing against each other to make sure that it's them that gets the call. And the last, they don't want another person in the market.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be the case. And I feel like anything more I say about it will just get me gossiping. And so we'll talk about something else.
All right. So that's our suggestion on that. Moving right along. Good friend of the show. This is Mr. JF Dubow, who quite a successful. We're watching the ascendancy of his writing career. The last book that he put out, The Life Engineered, has done really well. Fantastic reviews. And he's got another book coming out. So let's get this. Let me dive right into this very lengthy email. The short version. I'm launching a crowdfunding campaign within a month. I'll have some experience with these kinds of campaigns. While I have some experience funding a book on Inkshares, I remain terrified of the prospect and would like to make sure I don't miss a beat and make this as smooth an experience as any crowdfunding campaign can be. The campaign is for a book, the sequel to my first book, The Life Engineered, which was published on Inkshares on the Sword and Laser Collection. I know Justin's done a great job with The Contender. Brian has demonstrated unparalleled talent in getting attention for his various projects. And Andrew, well, we like him. This is Andrew's got a grasp of publishing, blah, blah, blah. I figure that if the boys can Voltron the blank out of some kick-ass advice, I might have a chance of making it out in one piece. The long version, in order to make this more legible and less of a pain in the ass to go through, here's a list of things I'm planning on or having done in bullet forms. It's planning to do a crowdfunding campaign for a book. One, the book is a sci-fi novel about robots, which is a sequel to my first book. It's twice the size and a more complex and compelling story, I hope. Two, the first draft is written already and samples can and will be picked out from it to showcase during the campaign. Three, I plan on doing the campaign in three stages. Currently, the book is an idea on Inkshares and has over 120 followers. In a couple weeks, I'll be upgrading to a draft, which will include cover art, synopsis, blah, 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 teaser, campaign, etc. The third stage is upgrading to a full campaign. I have four vectors of communication with existing readers. He says, I've got an author newsletter with about 100 subscribers, followers of the draft, 120, followers of the first book, 703, followers of my second book currently, 812. Inkshares require 750 pre-orders to publish and usually sells books in three ways. Ebooks 10, signed a number 20, three times signed a numbered paperback acknowledgement, 60. I plan a 90-day campaign of hitting up any and all blog and media who have talked about my books to help. I'm considering adding a fourth level to pre-orders. So he wants advice on launching this.
Okay. I mean, the things I liked. I like the fact that he's going with Inkshares again. I say again, but his first book was on Inkshares, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay. The things I'm concerned about is that it seems like banging the gong to announce you have a first draft written, there's a serious backlash against incomplete projects on crowdfunding of all variety.
To be clear though, I think on Inkshares, that's part of is to say that like I do, it's not a book that I want to write, but no, I do have this book written. So it's not if people agree to buy the book, I'll go write the book. So I think that is a step that's required for Inkshares.
Right. No. Right. That's what I'm saying. But I guess my question is, is there a reason that the crowdfunding campaign is happening at the first draft level, not 6 months from now at the final level? Or
I think to limit the amount of time, because once the book is finished, he doesn't want to have to wait another 90 days to then release it.
Okay. You know what? This is just a different animal than what I'm familiar with. What's your gut on this?
For me, the idea of crowdfunding a book, unless it involves like you need money to research and do things to do that, is sort of a weird idea to me, because it's like you write a book, you sell the book. You can certainly start the hype and promotion for the book. And so it's a different thing for me. I would say to give a more generalized advice is you clearly need to, any type of crowdfunding campaign, you can predict, probably a good predictor for your success is how many people do you have direct access to right now. How many people can you reach? How many people can you reach out and touch? Why did Brian's Indiegogo campaign to launch Scam Stuff succeed? Of course, Brian's a smart guy. Of course, Brian's got good taste. Of course, Brian's a good magician. Brian has between email, YouTube, Twitter, podcasts. I mean, think of all those things I just named. Huge footprint. Huge, huge, huge footprint. So he could get that word out. He's already got contact with people who like his stuff. A large field, large that. And a lot of times people want to launch, I'm going to put this on Kickstarter. It's like, and you see the first few hours, they've only got like one person. It's like your friends didn't even support this. Your friends didn't even jump into this. Why is this? It's not because they're bad friends. I would say on net, our friends are all average in how loyal they are. It's because there's a communication problem there. I would say, you know, make sure that your reach can be, you know, how do you increase your reach? How do you build that up? Different ways to do that. You know, our buddy Scott Sigler, Scott's between his podcast and pushing content out there. Scott's a super aggressive guy when it comes to that and a super good guy. So it works out really well. So I would say that, you know, when you launch it, you know, you certainly do, you have 90 days, which is good. Kickstarter is terrifying because you have 30 days in the first few days. If there's no momentum on it, you know, you can kind of, it's going to nosedive. You want to make sure that you can get buzz and excitement. Like if I were to do a Kickstarter project, I would do a launch 30 days before the Kickstarter of just like, hey, I'm going to be doing this thing, you know, tell your friends, whatever, help me, you know, if you can help support when I push this thing. So then when I do tell people, hey, it's here, it's not like in the middle of the night out of nowhere, like, hey, I'm doing a Kickstarter. I'm like, what?
Yeah, no, that's the understand the entire crowdfunding process is largely a performance that you are doing. You behind the scenes should have a pretty good idea of how many people will sign up immediately for it and how many will tell their friends and so on. If at all, you of everyone should be the least surprised at every phase of the crowdfunding thing. Now, that doesn't mean you don't act surprised. That doesn't mean you don't freak out and be like, holy crap, 10% of the way there in just 24 hours. That's big news. Look at us, momentum. Let's go. That's great. And that's fine. Figure out a schedule and targets and milestones that you have to hit and when you have to hit them. But more importantly, figure out what it is that you're offering. Like I guess nobody's going to be more likely to read your second book than those who read your first book. So I would say figure out a way to start a dialogue in advance with everybody who has bought your book. If you are having a conversation, if you have become genuine friends with this, you said the email list is 100 people long. Start interacting directly. And I don't mean just posting press releases. I'm saying, say, hey guys, do you have 5 seconds? I just put a poll here and about whether I should do this second book or not. Can you click on it? And or hey, write me back. Which of these two titles do you think is better or whatever? And genuinely have a conversation. Crowdfunding campaigns work when you've already built up value with someone. This is it. This is what I'm trying to say. Crowdfunding campaigns work because they are harvests, not seed plantings. You need to have been planting the seeds all the way. You don't show up at harvest and say, yeah, well, from what I understand, you can get 10% of your goal by just starting on harvest day. You, what are you planting right now so that you have multiple phases? You need to build your arsenal of messages to have and stories to tell so that you do your opening salvo and you let them know in advance, hey, man, harvest day is in 30 days, 15 days, 10 days, 5 days. We'd love a big bunch. You know, give me your ideas of how we can promote this or whatever. 3, 2, 1. Oh, it's harvest day. Then the next phase starts. 24 hours in, we're 10% funded. This is the best day ever. Now it's time for phase 2. I'm doing a secret giveaway of original signed copies of book 1 to anyone who can, you know, get this in the hands of a blogger or whatever. You know, whatever it is. Make your team understand that that is your street team who's going to work for you. Give them all very clear goals about what they can do to help. And they don't need to be monetary goals because people who love your stuff, your number one biggest best fan, can only buy the book once. After that, it gets weird. He's buying copies from other people. But that super fan might be able to identify bloggers and reviewers and other people to get you on their radar, especially if you can figure out with an unconventional aspect to the campaign that is newsworthy or noteworthy.
Absolutely. Build that email list, get it bigger. And here's some suggestions on how to do that. Write some short stories and give away short stories to everybody who signs up for my newsletter email. I'm going to be giving away a short story that takes place in this universe, a standalone, whatever. HarperCollins had me do that between Angel Killer and the Name of the Devil, they had me like, hey, can you write a short story? So I wrote a short story, and that became its own thing that was connected, you know, between the two stories. And it was done as a, hey, you know, sign up for, you know, or pre-order the book, whatever, get the short story. You can use that. You know, use your writing as the hook. Offer this out there. Like, hey, everybody who signs up for my newsletter, get this free short story, whatever. Do that because you want to build up that list. And as Brian says, interact. I write one line responses, but somebody sends me an email, thanks so much, whatever, you know, whenever they like something, and I write a one sentence thing. Thank you. I appreciate it. I let people know they hear me. Same thing with Twitter. I try to stay on top of Twitter every day, and everybody who's at replied me, say something back or like it or whatever, and just let people know that it's an engaged thing. And, you know, Brian and I both, we follow a lot of people, and we always get these kind of like, oh, looks like so-and-so follows a lot of people. Oh, you're going to get a response from me.
Oh, sure. You know? Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is the presumption, of course, is like, oh, they follow a bunch of people, but they don't listen. It's like, no, I listen to every word and I respond to every single one of you, you know? And once you have that, it gives you value so that now you have that interaction and you can ask for that favor. That's an important thing.
Yeah. It's funny because like it's statistically not that much easier to follow 800 people that it is to follow 8,000. It just you the conversation is still a blur, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's like when I get that criticism, like, you know, I don't think you're, you know, if you're following a significant number of people, you're not really paying attention.
So, well, anyway. Back to JF's situation, I would say just remember that campaign is the ending. The real campaign starts today, but the question is, you know, what when the battle happens, how many salvos do you have? How many different operations do you have in your arsenal? Because the one thing you cannot do is say like, well, I launched the video. And then just wait. You have to have your wave 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 things to do.
Yeah. So put together a list, plan a blog or plan a podcast tour, put a list of all the literary podcasts that you have. Think of different angles to go in there and talk about it. A lot of those literary podcasts, they're not so much readers as much as people who are writers. That's the sort of thing you have to know about. Is say, hey, I'm an author who's done a successful, you know, Inkshares campaign before. I'm about to launch another one. Love to talk about my book and what it's like to work with Inkshares. Use that as a hook. You know, what's it like to do crowdfunding book stuff? And that will, you're helping other writers out, which will incur this sort of reciprocity. So I would put that out there. Like, that would be my hook. Like, hey, I'm, you know, one sentence. I've written a book. I'm doing my second Inkshares campaign, my last one was a success. I'd love to come talk about my book and talk about working with crowdfunded writing. And push that out to all the literary podcasts you can, and blogs, and just you need to. What is a publicist? Is a Rolodex. A publicist is a list of contacts, and not everybody. And that's the thing, is we get into this mindset of like, oh, well, I asked a couple of people and they turned me down. I'm like, yeah, you didn't ask enough. You've got to go to, you know, if your response rate is 5%. Which means, you know, 1 out of 20, I'm going to do some math for you guys, 1 out of 20 are going to say yes, and you want to get onto 10 different outlets, then that means you got to contact 200.
Yeah, and by the way, here's the best part. After you contact that 200 and you get those 10 appearances or whatever, you now have 190 contacts ripe to be asked again. Because understand, I got told no multiple times by the Tonight Show.
No, Brian, no!
I got told no until I asked at the right time. And then they were like, oh yeah, no, that'd be great. And then once you did it the one time, it's a lot easier to get in the second time.
The problem we have, and I'm so guilty of this, is that there are things we want, and we want the universe to give them to them as soon as we ask for them. We don't want to do any groundwork, and then if we don't get it, we just give up on it. Where the key is to persistence, is a process, is to say, okay, when I want to get my story out there, I'm going to go to these 20 different outlets and pitch it to them, you know, because I know it's not going to be I get asked periodically to do podcasts, and often if I'm in the middle of writing, I can't, and I need to figure out a better way to maintain those relationships. So when I do want to do podcasts, that it works out well for both of us. And so, you know, I would say just put together an actual list of every outlet you want to reach and then plan, push.
I think you touched on something I think is really important. It is a very, very tempting fantasy for us to believe that when big success comes, it comes to people who are inherently talented and it happens because they're talented. It's just not true. At some level, even if it's not that person who's hustling really hard to get his own awards, somebody who's being paid by that person or somebody who's owning a piece of that pile, PewDiePie is hustling really hard to make that happen. And the best example I could think of is, you know, you think of the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You think of the, those are all people who made it. They sell, people buy those stars. Those are awards. Not one person on the Hollywood Walk of Fame was given it. Every single one had to campaign for the opportunity to buy their own award. Was it like $10,000 or $20,000?
I'm sure they may have given away a couple, but yeah, exactly. The Walk of Fame is you pay for, but again, you have to one qualify for one. No, you can't just be anybody and be like, I want a star. They get approached all the time by people like, no, you're not, you don't qualify because you know you're not noteworthy enough in this category. But once you are, they're like, yes, we will let you pay us.
Well, or at least convinced people that you're noteworthy in that category. Oftentimes you have managers who labor for years, literal years, campaigning over and over and over again, saying like, hey, man, you think I think we can do that star thing yet? You know, we got that check. We're willing to write, blah, blah, blah. And when they win, when they get there, it is a triumph. But when they look at that star, they don't think, oh, we've made it. Everyone loves us so much. They gave us a star. They think that is the work of 3 years of hard hustle and tens of thousands of dollars.
Yep. That's, you know, Oscar time. So living in LA, when, you know, Emmy Awards and Oscars come up, everywhere you look are for your consideration. And it's not like that in the rest of the country.
No.
It's here.
Yeah.
It's you know, the what they do, they throw – I went to an event for it was at the Fox lot, and it was for The Martian, and they had Ridley Scott there, Andy Weir was there, and all. It was a really cool event. You know, they were up there talking about it. I'm like, this is really nice of Fox. Oh, Oscar time.
Yeah, they're not doing anything nice, you know.
it's Oscar time. This is why they did it, was to, and it was a smart event. You know, they had NASA people, whatever. It was a great event. It was because they wanted to make sure The Martian got an Oscar, and so they were doing events to get people to, you know, show up and participate and talk about what important
and
movie was.
Here's the weird part. At the end of the day, none of that active campaigning, none of that money spent made that Oscar any less incredibly valuable. Like, they won the prize. They got the presidency. They were elected to Congress. That's what it means to run a campaign, and you are running a campaign to – and you, I don't want you to look at, you know, this 100 sales of the book and say like, oh, but those 100 sales only happened because I hustled really hard and did this one podcast and asked these people as a favor and then traded out, you know, a plug for this other guy's stuff. It's like, at the end of the day, you want to sell those, you get a campaign. You're in politics now.
Yep. It's just push, 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 and always on it. It gets frustrating. It gets time consuming. And, you know, I've been part of projects where, you know, when I see the success of it is because the people in the, at the inception have a really good plan. And then I can kind of predict early on if this is a succeed or fail, because, you know, you're like, nobody's there. Everybody's waiting for somebody else to do this thing.
Yeah. Everybody's agreed that it's a good thing. And, but nobody's willing to do the to get the grit. And I don't want to hear about how you only know three podcasts. Yeah, call up everyone whose podcast you've been on and say, who do you know that knows?
Go to iTunes and look up Literary.
Yeah, and just go.
Go down the list.
Straight on down.
Well, Brian, you have any picks?
I guess I do. Oh, you know what? This is a sideways pick. This is not going to make your life better. I just want to mention it because it was a lot of fun. Raw Data is finally out on the Vive VR, and it's still a pre-alpha thing. It's still, you know, you're paying some bucks for an incomplete game, but it's but you get to be along the process of it getting better and better over time. And for the first time, I played Raw Data. The game is real simple. You stand behind a console, and robots just keep walking at you, and you keep shooting them or punching them.
I'm going to interrupt you here, Brian.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you something, folks. The problem with watching video game previews for virtual reality, it ain't nothing like playing the game.
Well, that's what I was about to say, is that this, it feels almost like a nightmare. You know, like those moments and nightmares where you turn and whoopsie, they're upon you and you're dead. That happens. And last night I had a magical experience. For the first time ever, I played Raw Data with another person live back to back. Me and Jeff Cannata played through just the first basic rounds, And it's astonishing because you reach down, you pull out the gun in your right hand. You have to keep the side squeezed while you hold it. If you want to, you could toss it from one hand to the other. But then you, when you run out of ammo, you have to reach down, grab a clip, put it in, and keep on going. And the best part was, you know, I would glance over my shoulder.
Clipper magazine, Brian.
And you could point. Okay, whatever. You could point. You know, it's like, hey, to your left, to your right, or whatever. When every time a wave would finish, I would turn and face the full-bodied avatar, Jeff Cannata, and we would actually high-five each other. It was like we were there. It was so much fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's one thing. You'll see these things where you watch the video of like, oh, it looks cool. Like, yeah, but when you're in VR, it's incredible. Incredible. That looks amazing. And when I saw the shot there of the robot crawling along towards the, like, oh god.
Oh dude, it is
over,
horrific. Dude.
Game over. let's go to picks. That was yours.
Yep.
And mine is so I've been working on a software project, which we'll talk about a little bit later on in another episode here. The short version is I had to teach myself Rails and Ruby and all that. And I say teach is learn enough to do things and then where to find answers to stuff. But
sure.
As I've been doing this, I have sitting next to me my iPad Pro on a stand, which I just use to watch movies while I, figure out why my logout procedure doesn't work when I'm in HTTPS, but works in HTTP when I'm using, Cloud9 on my development environment. And so I watch I've been watching tons of movies. And I watched a movie like I never saw before. And I'm like, what a perfectly fun movie for this genre. What a perfectly, and it's time frame. It's wonderfully encapsulated. A delightful movie by a director who has now gone on and did some other really interesting things. Bring It On.
Oh, no kidding.
It was such a really well done, in the genre of cheerleader movies, very well told. It was done by Peyton Reed, who written by Jessica Bendiger. Peyton Reed directed Ant-Man.
Oh, wow.
And so this was like 2000 when this came out with. And so it's like, one of Kirsten Dunst's big first starring roles. I mean, she was in other things like Small Soldiers and stuff. Eliza Dushku. I mean, just an interesting cast. Gabrielle Union, great cast. Just you look at this cast that so many of them just went on to do bigger and amazing things from there. Great casting, really, really well put together. Just a funny movie, just a well put together stuff. So my pick is Bring It On. So.
Dude, that's great. Yeah, that's one of those things where it's like you got to remember just because you're not into a thing. Like I'm not into jazz music, but Whiplash was a really tightly well-told story.
Yeah. Oh, I'm into cheerleading. It was what worked for me in it from deconstructing it from a storytelling point of view was every character was pretty – had a dimension to them, was pretty developed. The universe – it's this perfect San Diego town sort of environment. I'm fascinated by stories that take place in these where they have a very good sense of what the look is going to be, how it's going to fit in and all this. Somebody point out, hot girls dancing. And I would say in exception – like the choreography in there was fantastic and they did – it was you've seen some of these like, oh, we'll just put together like a really quick dance movie or whatever, and it's not as good because they're just don't put as much attention to that. Where I thought here they really every detail was thought when in every detail had consideration. And as a writer, I think about, I need to think about that. Like, okay, is that person in the room they have a conversation with, is that a real person or is that just a device to move to the next plot point? And is this just a room or is there a purpose? Or not that everything has to be described in exquisite detail. There's a creator you need to know. So yeah. That was a lesson learned from Bring It On.
By the way, I am feeling that lesson very, very much now. Right before we went live, I was talking about how I watched took the kids to see Secret Life of Pets. And in a world where I was lamenting how Finding Dory was nowhere near as tight a script or as well-developed a world as Zootopia, all of a sudden Secret Life of Pets is – a fine example of somebody who waves their hands and say, yeah, we got great animators. We have the best animators. We got, you know, they know what to do. We have great set pieces. We've got licensed musics. You know, we'll just put it all together. And it very much just feels like next set piece because now this happens and now this happens, now this happens. And there was just so many wasted moments that didn't go anywhere, threads that didn't get picked up, characters that just suddenly flipped to another thing for no reason. When you compare that to the masterful storytelling and world building that we got from the likes of Zootopia, you can really see the difference.
Interesting point. That's these things matter, folks. And sometimes it's not that it's the, I mean, I'm trying to figure out like an analogy to it. It's not that the craftsmanship you apply to the smallest detail is going to affect the overall appearance. You know, you want to build a beautiful building, you have to do, it's a sum of a bunch of really well-crafted parts.
Yeah, you know what I what it felt like? It felt like the Cargo Cult's Secret Life of Pets. It was like, mm-hmm. I don't understand. We had all the things Zootopia had. We had the cute animals and the city and the blah, blah, blah. Why aren't the planes arriving? I don't get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a movie, you know, conceived well before the success.
I know. But just looking like, why didn't it work? Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was the thing where, you know, the ad campaigns, I'm like, well, it's got, you know, an interesting topics, you know, but like in the trailer, I never saw a plot. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Next week when Justin's back here, we'll talk about Rogue One.
Oh, shoot. New news on that, right?
New footage.
Oh, okay. All right. I haven't seen it yet. So good. Good.
Next week, Brian.
Love you guys. Right.
Thank you. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.